Bert Frost, March 20th, 1970.
So that reminds me about your father. They tell me he came from Nova Scotia.
He did.
Where was it?
Digby Neck.
Digby Neck.
Yeah.
Where is that now? Is that...
Well, there's a... there's a neck. Lays down in here. Piece of paper. I thought it was
simpler. All right. Well, let's see now. Is it up there by the head of Fundy, or...?
No.
On the inside. What you need is a permanent drawing board right with you.
Oh, yeah.
How'd you like cigarettes?
Yeah.
One of those Newports. Right,
I never smoked one. Well, menthol, I think.
Yeah, but not heavy.
No.
Right straight out of Machias.
Right straight out of Machias, huh?
Yeah.
St. John, New Brunswick claimed over here. Look ahead to Bay of Fundy, make way up in here.
Yeah, yeah.
Then you come down, there's Annapolis Basin. Mm-hmm. And you take longer than right here. And you come down into Digby, way down here into Digby Basin.
Mm-hmm.
And you come out, you go right down this long neck of land, 35 miles long, Digby Neck.
Huh.
On the Bay of Fundy side, Bay of Fundy over here, there's what is known as coves. There's not the shelter, they're just indentations all along here. It's all very ragged coast, and where there would be a cove, would be the beaches would be these big, heavy popplestones.
Oh, yeah.
You hear them rumble and roll with the tides.
Yeah.
Tide rise and falls in this area is only about 40 feet all along here.
Brother.
You come down to the end of Digby Neck, and you have to keep passage.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have Long Island, Grand Passage, and Briar Island.
Yeah.
It's just a little town in here called Tiverton. Down in here is Freeport, and you cross Grand Passage, and you're over into Westport.
Mm-hmm.
Then this neck makes up in here, and then you start. This is all red sand and clay up in here. This is St. Mary's Bay side.
Uh-huh.
In the first harbor you come into here, and it's a fairly little harbor. I'm more than call it a little river. I have people, plenty of people live there now.
Mm-hmm.
It's bone dry at low tide, but it got about 40 feet of water at high tide.
Uh-huh. It's like the head of Yarmouth Harbor there.
Yeah. Then you go up, and you probably come to Mink Cove.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next place is Sandy Cove. And then you go way up, and come way up into the head of the bay up under there called Barton.
Uh-huh.
Then you start down French Shore, and you come down here to Yarmouth, way over in here.
Yeah, yeah.
See?
Yeah.
And my father...
The Long Shoals is right up here. Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
My father... was born in Little River, Nova
mm-hmm.
Scotia, on the east side of Digby Neck.
Mm-hmm.
There's a cove here, just below Little River, and right down in here called Whale Cove. This is where I was born.
Uh-huh.
And my father was known anywhere along the shore. He was a terrific fisherman when a young man, and this was when there was all sailboats and rowing.
Yeah.
And I believe when he told me, he talked with me, they had a lot of little low-sided sailboats cut off stern and rudder.
Uh-huh.
I don't think they carried a jib, and they may have. I never inquired into that much because I always power came in my arms.
I bet you they were spritzel rigged.
And they were kitted off, and they always had a good pump. The pump was a wooden handmade pump.
Uh-huh.
And I know they were taking the mast and sail down. Stow it on one side.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Now, I think...
It was an open boat, right?
It was an open boat.
With thwarts across.
Yeah, and I think they used to have... there was a legion of lady ballers in a gimbals here to haul the trawl fish a lot.
Yeah.
They would go 1 or 2 days, and they'd, what they call, drifting
mm-hmm.
with a net to catch big heron for bait.
Uh-huh. Sort of like a sea anchor.
Huh?
Sort of like a sea anchor, too, in a way.
Yeah, well, they drifted attached to it.
Oh, I see.
At
yeah.
night.
Yeah.
And they'd go over to do this. To do this, they'd go over. Grand Manan laid over over here.
Yeah.
You get this awful tide out of the Bay of Fundy.
Oh,
and off of the southeast tip of Grand Manan is a famous tide rip called the Bulkhead Rip.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you've ever heard tell of it.
I came across one time by Long Falls there. And got about 6 mile an hour tide rip there.
That's right. Well, they used to go into the mill tail of this after heron.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, Pollock was chasing the heron and everything, and but yeah. They was after heron.
Yeah.
And then they'd sail in here to Whale Cove, and that's just to bait their trawls with.
Uh-huh.
Father had never could swim. He had no fear of the water, though.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess he's pretty typical in that, isn't he?
Huh?
He's pretty typical in that, isn't he?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, you don't last long in it.
Yeah, no sense though.
And there was the fatality rate. Wasn't great. No greater than they are today, because
yeah.
I've heard Dad say he sailed the mast right out of him. Heard people tell about it.
Yeah.
Hard sailor and everything. He would go when everybody else tied up.
Yeah.
He was a driver. He had no fear. Big fisherman. If he caught fish, and everybody chased him.
Yeah. He set up trawls for ground.
Yeah. I hardly have a hand line, just trawl.
Yeah.
And I guess at the age of 18, he decided he wanted to build his own boat.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, remember, my father came into existence before the gas engine did.
Yeah, yeah. When was he born?
Well, I wouldn't know, but Dad had been dead 5 years ago, this coming May, and he was 91.
Okay, that fixes back.
They're 96 to from 1970.
Okay. So 96, so we go back to my arithmetic movie. Okay, the 26 years before that, the 74.
Yeah, that's about right, 1874.
Yeah.
So, when Dad was a young fella, I've heard him tell about it. All I go is what hearsay on this.
Mm-hmm.
I guess when he was a young fella, but he didn't go to school. His father died when he was 14,
mm-hmm.
and he supported his mother and three or four sisters
mm-hmm.
until Papa didn't get married as much as 25.
Mm-hmm.
And he took care of grandmother for us. He lived with us, and he buried her, paid her burial expenses and everything. But he went to Boston, I guess, near 17 or 18, like all young fellas. Boston was a big city and a big call. And he went there, and I think he worked on an ice wagon for a while. And, of course, boats always stuck in his crop. And at the time he was in Boston, it was about the time they were coming out with outside ballasted keel yachts.
Mm-hmm.
Everything previous to that was centerboard.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he got down around Marblehead or somewhere, and he sees some of these boats, and of course that stuck in his head. And Dad and I is the same. Whatever we see stuck by us, pertaining to boats.
Yeah, yeah.
So, anyway, he came back, and I guess gasoline engines were just starting to get out single cylinders. A Mayanis, the first one,
uh-huh.
made in Mayanis, Connecticut.
Uh-huh.
And Dad got the agency for it in Nova Scotia, in Digby Neck. I think
uh-huh.
he told me he sold 18 of them in 1 year. That would be a tremendous record.
I'd say.
Because it was pretty hard to part the old-timers from a sailboat
sure.
to an old gas engine you didn't know nothing about, whether it was going to run or anything, see.
Yeah.
Well,
what did they put those engines in?
Well, I don't know unless they started off putting them in these little sailboats.
Mm-hmm. Looks like a Hampton boat, pretty much.
Huh?
Looks a lot like a Hampton
boat. Yeah, but Dad, he got tired of, he built his first boat, and I believe it was a sailboat, when he was 17.
Mm-hmm.
Who he took it from, my grandfather was a shipbuilder, but he was this was wooden ships, it was square riggers and things. I mean, there's quite some difference.
Yeah, yeah.
But Papa's father was a Baptist minister, and I guess a house carpenter was. Now, Father had one brother, Daniel, was older than him, built a few boats, but he hated boats, but he was a wonderful architect in the buildings and houses, and he took a flair for that.
Yeah.
Dad had a brother older than him, who today would be a historian, he'd be a student, he'd read. They said he was lazy, but he wasn't. He was trying to educate himself. After all, they didn't get beyond the fourth grade. That was big things in those times. The only education they got in those times, I'm giving you a long story, but probably it all pertains and ties in. But I've heard Dad tell about the Baptist church there, and of course the church, everything centered around church, and this is all they had.
Yeah.
Now, I've heard Dad say that the British Crown, of course Canada was a colony of England, and I've heard Dad say when he was a young man, wonderful singers and choirs in the churches when I was a kid down there. See, I was born there. So, wonderful singing. Wow, harmony, wonderful. Oh, and big choir, lovely. In a little hamlet of 500 population, they have a choir that'll knock your ear out.
Yeah.
And I asked Papa, how come my father's a wonderful tenor, beautiful, beautiful Irish tenor.
Mm-hmm.
And I says, how come, Dad? Well, he says, you know, Bert, he says the British Crown used to send craftsmen around. Now, he said, there was a Mr. Cute. By trade, he was a... Oh, you're going to all them old homes down, most beautiful green work on the woodwork. You ever see those old homes and that beautiful green work?
Yes.
And do it with combs and
stuff? Yes.
Oh, well, they're there yet, a lot of them, but they're rotting down now. Nobody don't appreciate that there. They can't, you know.
Yeah, they don't know what
But we lived in a house, it was all beautiful things, most beautiful. Well, it was an old spruce board, and they green it, and it was beautiful. It stayed there, it was fast and nice. Well, Mr. Chu, this was his trade, and I guess he'd do a whole, come and do a whole house for it for a $5 bill. He was showing his skill, see, and he trained in England. Besides this, he was a talented musician, generally piano and harpsichord and organ.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd get all the people together in the little village school. They'd hold a prayer meeting, or they would have choir rehearsal there, and he taught them voice and reading music.
Mm-hmm.
See, everybody could read music, and he taught them harmony.
Dad,
there were 10 kids of us in my family, and we were taught the same way. Now, in my family, we had a male quartet. We sang on radio. We didn't get the TV. That was beyond our time. We sang all the lodges and churches all over the state.
Son of a gun.
In Rhode Island, Massachusetts.
Is this a barbershop type quartet?
This was a regular, beautiful, balanced quartet. Sacred music.
Yes, gospel.
Sacred music. We used to do a lot of English ballads and things, too, see?
Yeah.
When the corn is waving, Annie dear, I'll take you home again. A thing you get some harmony on.
Yeah.
Where the sunset turned the ocean blue to gold, all the old, old tunes.
Yeah.
It was beautiful harmony in it, see? And I sing bass.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a bass singer. I still sing the choir over in the Congregational Church.
Mm-hmm.
And so they was taught the music. And I mean they were taught it. The old fellow was severe with them. They had to be there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They could read music. And they knew harmony. They knew when someone was discarding.
Yeah.
They knew when their organist was right and wrong. They all knew their counts. And this is good. We don't get it today.
Sure.
You get way up in college today before you get what I'm talking about,
right.
See?
Yeah.
Now, this was all given to them. Now they found time for this, and they found time, and they had big families. There's 10 in my family.
Mm-hmm.
My older sister, 70. She lived in Freeport, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, there's two sisters and a brother dead. And there's 7 of us living. So, anyway, we get back to the boat area. Now, Father could see that the sailboat was, in other words, let's say he was modern way back in his day.
Mm-hmm.
And always was to a certain point. Father never got over a narrow boat.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, when Pop come up into the modern age and you started getting big power and things, he still thought you had to push a boat through the water, not over it,
uh-huh.
See.
Uh-huh.
So he never built a very wide boat per length. It always was narrow, puppet boat, but they go like hell on good sea boat. Now, it came up to this sailboat, and it was too small, and bucking the Fundy tide, there's lots of times you just went with the tide.
Yeah.
You'd duck into some cove and stay there till the tide turned, and you went with it the other way.
Yeah.
And he came out when the Mayanus engines come out, and he got this idea on him. And he came out with in Nova Scotia, with practically the same lobster boat that he introduced in Jonesport.
Mm-hmm.
And they were 33 feet long. At that time, they had a box stern on them. That would be a slanted stern like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it went to a V like that on top, and it looked like that looking down on it.
Oh, yeah, rounded on the bottom and V on top. Yeah.
And it looked like that. Now, these boats were very low-sided because the fishermen always felt, well, you just should reach down and grab your trap,
yes.
Buoy.
Yeah.
If you didn't, if you lost your gaff, you'd still grab your buoy.
Yeah.
In the Nova Scotia type boat, they had a bullhead on the stem, they call it, this. And they always had a pin through here that they dropped their mooring. And they always used a big long mooring that stuck out of water about 10 feet like that with a big rope leader that hung down.
Yeah, I see?
At low tide, this damn thing would be laying out practically full length. Well, it'd be laying about an angle, just like that, and your boat be laying way off, see?
Yeah.
This is where you
took care of the slack on the high tide.
Yeah. Now, this is before they had breakwaters, and this one they'd open to the elements.
Yeah.
Now the government's built all these overcrossed docks and things, and they've, they give them something to lay to.
Yeah.
These boats were kitted off They're very narrow, about 6 foot wide.
Mm-hmm. 30 feet.
Yeah, and on the only the Nova Scotia lobster boat had a quite a raking, stir a piece of pipe, and they had a tiller outside.
Mm-hmm.
And a notch iron here for the tiller.
Oh, yeah. You know that notch iron, as a matter of fact, I remember seeing some old prints in the 1880s
and
70s.
Notch iron was very necessary, the on-sail boat and the lobster boat. Now, when these guys are paying out trawls, they'd leave the rudder set in the notch iron.
Mm-hmm. Make a big
Now, they were all kitted off. The reason they kitted them off is on account of the different kinds of fish, and they could balance the boat up. They'd, see?
Yeah.
Now, they hauled way up
Were
from
these
the...
temporary partitions?
No, no. They're permanent. Uh-huh. Built right in. Now, they had a deck forward here about 5 feet long, and the combing was always went around, always bent on them.
Uh-huh.
A bent combing. You never see a square corner.
Yeah.
And up in the bow of them, they used to have a centerboard in them.
Coming down.
Dropped right down here in the water. This was to keep them up in the tide.
Yes.
When they were setting trawls.
Yeah, keep them from blowing off, I suppose.
That's right, keep them from blowing off.
Were they fairly shallow for beaching forwards?
No, they were like the Jonesport boat.
Uh-huh.
Pretty good.
Pretty deep.
Yeah.
And they're round bottom boat, of course.
Oh, yeah. And they had the centerboard here, and they used to have a rod they used to haul it up with and then break the rod down and catch it with under a thong.
Yeah.
And they used to have a lingam-vitae bollard right up in here, and there's a guy stood in his forward kid right here, and they hold the trawl in over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The guy behind him shook the fish off, and the engine was in a box right in here.
About amidships.
Yeah, and they had a hollow keel,
uh-huh.
plank down keel. Now, the one he built that was famous, and she lived a long while for a Novi boat, was Ethel Maud.
Mm-hmm.
Now that boat, she hadn't been gone many years. I think that lasted 50 years.
My, that's quite a bit.
He built that for an uncle of mine who's now living in Little River, Nova Scotia, in Digby Neck.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a boy, 15 years old. Grandfather let him have the money to build it, and I think Papa said he built it for $125.
Boy.
Ready to go fishing. I think the engine at that time cost $150. And make and break my anus.
Yeah.
And that thing raced the whole length of the Bay of Fundy. Everybody, people used to write letters and invite and challenge them up Digby,
uh-huh.
Annapolis. And it all over, and it was noted far and wide.
Mm-hmm.
Well, somehow through this, Father built, dozens of them then.
Yeah.
Very similar. Because someone wanted to beat the other guy. Some they put two engines in.
Uh-huh.
Now, when they put two engines in, they put one out through the center, and then they made a log. It went right out through the hull,
uh-huh.
built it down, hung another propeller there.
Yeah.
On the port side, on the wasting the works, they all worked uh-huh. on the starboard side.
Yes.
Now that right there is the start in the father's brainchild in the boat. Now this here was done, evidently must have come out round. Father must have come out with it probably around 1903
mm-hmm.
or 4, somewhere like that.
Yeah, the engines were getting pretty popular then.
Yeah, they were just starting to get reliable then, see?
Yeah.
Now, he built a tugboat. And he shouldn't have done it because he lost his ass. He didn't know how to figure it. He had a crowd of Frenchmen. He couldn't talk French, and they was frigging him behind his back.
Yeah.
And he lost everything. And he was pretty discouraged, and he went fishing again. My grandfather, who was a big fish dealer right here in Digby Neck at Whale Cove.
Mm-hmm.
But his grandfather couldn't hitch it off too good, because my grandfather was a burly old Englishman, and father was a very lithe, gay fellow, you know what
mm-hmm.
I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he probably thought father wouldn't amount to nothing, because papa married his oldest daughter,
uh-huh.
and mama had children fast, but papa never ever let none of us starve. Good mm-hmm. provider. Very honest, never drank. So, anyway, I guess father got from the losing on the tugboat, which he never should have built. He got discouraged, pretty discouraged, and some friend of his, in fact, a second cousin of my mother, married a girl from Grand Manan.
Mm-hmm.
And he, in turn, came over on this side, and this side at that time, the main industry was sardines.
Mm-hmm. They had three factories.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And every one of these islands had a fish stand on it.
Yeah.
And it was sardines. So this John Titus, who was my mother's second cousin, came over here, and he settled here in his home right over here. He died 7 or 8 years ago, and his home has been sold to a college professor.
Mm-hmm.
But he used to correspond to father. His mother lived right near us in Nova Scotia, and he used to come down every Christmas, and his mother His mother and her sister and her brother all smoked the old TD pipes, and he used to come down and bring each one of them 10 pounds of plug tobacco for a Christmas present. And I'd see him smiling now, and they'd cut it with a paring knife and grind it. Yeah. And they'd smoke, and they'd set up, and he'd bring them a dozen little clay pipes. Mm-hmm. Of course, this was a normal thing in those times. No one thought anything of it. Well, he evidently must have run into Papa, and he said, Will, he says, what are you hanging around here for? He says, you'll never get anywhere. He says, if you want to build boats and a chance to use your brain, why don't you come over to Jonesport? Beale's Island at that time was part of Jonesport. See, Beale's Island became a town incorporated itself in 1924, three or four, one of the two. Mm-hmm. And so Papa came across in 1900 and... I think it was 1912. Mm-hmm. And he came to Beale's Island. And when he came across, there was a fellow of the name of George Addington who used to work with Father building boats down there. And he was younger than Father, but he learned his trade with Father, liked the boats. And he was single, and he always saved his money. And he said, Will, he says, I'll go over with you. So they went over, and they come on Beale's Island, and George had a little money. Well, coming on to Beale's Island at that time, they were so clannish and so scared of outside people. Oh, ye, everyone to come there, you either brought diphtheria or smallpox, you know what I mean? Sure. Whether you did or not, you did. I mean, that's the classification you had. See, you were strictly a foreigner, and they kept you that way. So anyway, Dad went on Beale's Island, and he hired an old smokehouse that had been abandoned. And he took it, and he put some windows in, and he had to whitewash it because it was all black inside, the soot where they smoked fish in it over the years. He had no machinery. He had no orders for boats. But he had this type of boat here, excepting he come over here, and there was a builder here named Morris Dow. Used to be down here on the end of Kelly's Point. Mm-hmm. Built a little round stern, torpedo stern boat. Mm-hmm. She was a funny-looking thing. She rounded on her bottom quite well, so her stern sat out of water somewhat like that, and you'd always hear her smacking.
Yes.
And one thing he did do, he was in mass production, didn't know it, he used to make his stern separate. He used to board them up and down.
Yep, vertical planking,
Just like that, and he used to hang them up overhead, half dozen at a time. And he built all one thing. They were 26-footers. They didn't go much. Mm-hmm. Laying in the morning, you hear them smack. If it was calm or anything, you hear them smacking.
The way they came out of the
underway, they'd rise and the stern would settle. And the bow, there was a pretty good looking boat, 26 feet. I never seen any bigger than that. And they were all powered with single cylinder engines. Mm-hmm. And they were a fairly wide boat for their length in proportion to one's father built. Mm-hmm. Well, anyway, that was a boat that was around here, and it never got out of this area, but it was handy.
Mm-hmm. It was now, an open launch with maybe a...
Yeah, that had a spray hood on it, and it had a tiller on the side. Mm-hmm. Spray hood here. Yeah. Engine box right here alongside a switch on the back of it. Right. And they could catch them on the switch and reverse them and beat the band.
Oh, yeah.
But you done all your hauling by hand.
Yeah.
Now, that was a lobster boat in this area then, and everybody, that was the popular boat, although there was another builder up West Jonesport, Frank Smith. Mm-hmm. He built a boat. Remember, previous to this, it was all friendship sloops around here.
Yes.
But they didn't adapt themselves to power due to the fact their keel getting through the bolts and things in there. There was, you know, you couldn't bore the shaft hole through. So there's some, when they did power them, they put a shaft log alongside, up through the garboard that way.
Out of the slight angle.
Yeah. Well, then the things drew so much water you couldn't get in around the rocks with them, and then you put the power to them, they just hauled their ass right to the water and stayed there and go before 5 miles an hour, see? So they couldn't do nothing, so they kept dropping out, see?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then Frank Smith up West Jonesport and a fellow on Beale's Island, George Brown, an old boat builder, they drowned. He was drowned. Brown was. Frank Smith is dead, and his son is builds one or two boats a year now up here.
Is that Oscar?
Oscar, yeah. Well, that boat they brought out that they had at that time was like a... It had quite a nice little knockabout bow on it, like this.
Mm-hmm.
The stern was cut in under something like a friendship sloop, and like that.
Mm-hmm.
And she came down, back and post, she had a rudder hung in here.
Mm-hmm.
She went along here. She had a hood on. And there were several of those around here when I was a kid. And there's one, I think, over on the point left right now.
Uh-huh.
And that was popular, but it wouldn't go. Uh-huh. 4 miles an hour. And that would haul right down, right, just like your friendship sloop,
yeah,
see.
She also had those muck lines with a curve.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, then Father came in and on his own, and nobody came near him. Everybody, oh, he's a foreigner. Stay away from him. He's a devil. So he came out with a boat very similar to the Thoroughbred.
Mm-hmm.
It was better than this Novi boat, very similar to the Thoroughbred. Only he took, he looked at these round sterns. These were too crude for Dad.
Mm-hmm.
And Dad brought out this cute torpedo stern, they call them. I don't know why they get the name, I'm sure. Where it comes up. They were, these boats, remember, they were low-sided. There's nothing Father could do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing you can do about it today. They still do the same thing.
Fishermen demanded, huh?
Fishermen demanded. They figure you had to reach down, wash your hands in the water.
Yeah.
Didn't want to lift that trap any higher than possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that, they, as I'm telling you, had a laminated stem.
Mm-hmm. Three-piece.
Three-piece stem.
Yeah.
They had a 7-foot deck here.
Mm-hmm. Forward.
Forward. They had a combing about 4 inches high above the deck.
Yeah.
That went aft. They had about a 4-inch deck aft. And these were always bent. There never was ever square cornered.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In aft on your stern, looking down on it, I'm just giving you the true detail. Probably this is what you want for.
This is just it, yeah.
Now, these combings on those boats were pretty much and symmetrical with the curve there.
Yeah, curve of the
stern. That's right. And up in forward, they went right up, and they they turned up in there pretty much, see?
Like a long end.
In later years, a little later in them, they started getting a more bold bend here so they could use more of the stern deck.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah, squared it off a bit.
See?
Yeah.
But always bent for years. It's only the past few years that they started using square corners in there.
Mm-hmm.
And they found out so much better.
Yeah.
Now, these boats had the deck was strip laid, they were caught, the plank was cedar, the stern, that was three oak strips bent within each other, and they were generally fastened too so they couldn't straighten, they were steamed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You mean like a shear clamp?
Yeah, like three laminates.
Yeah.
There's a...
Oh, I see, the whole top of the stern.
Oh, yeah.
It's a curved piece.
Oh,
three
right in here. There's three laminates.
That's right. You mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, we would glue those today to keep them straightening, but they didn't know that in those times.
And they just
pulled them. I had a stern post come down here, or this post here, and it was notched in here to receive the bows, and it was cut in there to receive the bows.
Yes.
And that came up here, and these was wide enough, about 4 inches up through them, so that you'd get a chance to come from a square out into a round here, and then these ribs were shaped in here.
Yes.
These are molded ribs.
Uh-huh.
And you want to remember each one of them would change as you came across around into your flat.
Yeah.
See?
Yeah. How many ribs did you have from the forward end of that?
They would be spaced there 10 inches on...
10 inches,
on centers around there. Yeah.
Yeah. And they'd be straight...
they'd be all...
Vertical?
Vertical, more or less vertical there. Mm-hmm. They'd go vertical there and then they kind of vertical. Now, some of them be shaped maybe like that. Maybe
crescent.
Come back, you'd have to bag them down more here towards the
village
as you started coming around, see?
Yeah, yeah.
And shear clamp in them was generally spruce. That was 2 by 3.5, and it was always riveted in, copper,
mm-hmm.
Galvanized rivets.
Uh-huh.
The nailing was galvanized, but it's just good galvanized, good Swedish steel. They'd
mm-hmm.
last for years.
Yeah.
The keel was very similar to this, except they didn't streamline to that extent.
Mm-hmm. So it was a plank, it was a deadwood skeg. Okay.
Deadwood skeg.
Uh-huh.
Once in a great while, someone would ask for a plank down keel, but very, very seldom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the first one he built was a deadwood skeg.
Right.
Yeah. Now, these earlier ones here, built by Smith, were they deadwood? Or
they were deadwood.
They were deadwood,
so were the Moore style job. They were all deadwoods.
Uh-huh.
That's right. Yeah.
Good.
Now that's it, and they steered, and they put a spray hood on them in the fall. In the summer, they opened and took the spray hood off.
Yes.
Long September, they put a spray hood on. They always had this tiller, a joystick on the side.
Yeah. Yeah.
You push your head to go to port, haul back, starboard, and straight up and down. Then you had a pulley here, and a couple of pulleys in here, and a tiller.
Yeah.
They were simplicity themselves.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, when they had the single cylinder engines in them, there was a box. Top came up, and generally the box could knock down with hooks in it.
Mm-hmm.
The rim of the flywheel came through, And they would take either the metal pin that was in that flywheel to crank the engine with. They'd either put some, they didn't have tape in those times, they'd take some fishing head in and put a, and seize in there. But most of them would take that metal plug out and put a wooden piece of broom handle in there. Then, what they'd do, they'd build a box, an open box, with the top open, because there was quite a few people around here stepped into those, got their legs stove up and the feet, you know. So they had that rig so that reached down in there and just flip her up against compression, see?
And then she'd spin in coverage.
Then, that took care of that. Now, it was quite a while they stayed on single cylinders, and then I've seen them put sometimes two in you. Very rare, as one boat did. All right, then father, about 1912, a big fisherman on Beale Down for his day, he came to father, Mr. Cross says, I'd like to have two engines put in my boat. Papa put two engines. Now he says, I'd like to get rid of the spray hood. He says, I'd like to have a trunk cabin on my boat. Now that trunk cabin was made, then it was sawed off, and he had it so he'd take it off in the summertime and set it on the bank, and in the fall he'd hook it back with hooks. And it had a little cuddy slide on one side, a little companionway slide on one side.
Sort of like they used to have on the
And a little, square window like that. Diamond window in it. Okay? And that was that. Well, that went along that way, and now father came here in 1912. He was only here and just barely got going. The first boat he built on speculation, and he built it all with hand tools, a hand rip saw, no machine. No machinery, all hand, and he built it. And there was a man on Beale's Island, he's dead now, a nice old man, Captain Frank Wallace. And he and his boy Oscar used to, well, they used to sneak in. They acted like someone had a drink and wanted to sneak it, you know.
Yeah.
Didn't want the rest of the natives to see him going into the cross shop.
That'd been bad.
And they come in, and he says, gosh, Mr. Frost says, I like the looks of that boat. He said, I don't know what she'll do, whether she'll dive and go to sight. He said, that's what everybody says she'll do.
I'm ready.
But he said, I'll tell you something. Now, he said, I got an engine setting up in the barn. He says, a 510 Hartford. And he said, I got a propeller and a shaft. He said, I'm going to let you have them put in that boat. And if she'll do what you say she'll do, he said, I'll buy her. So he let father have the engine, the shaft, and the propeller, and the stuffing boxes.
Yeah.
And papa put them in. And they took the boat out. Well, of course, when the news got around here, everybody cast a mooring hook could have a race. Of course, father was just going along with his engine cut way back on the gas. And, and of course, everybody come out, and God, he went right off. He went 2 miles for that one. He just doubled speed with the same policy. Well, then, that was dynamite. And then Frank Wallace took that boat, and his boy ordered the next one. And then Dad was able to go buy a bandsaw and a gas engine. He's able to get him some equipment. And he started in. In the meantime, we were living in Canada then, the whole family. Pup was born on Beale's Island. And he built several boats like that. Well, he hadn't got his, he'd taken a, he'd applied for his first citizenship papers, but he hadn't been for a hearing when the First World War broke out. And he had, in the meantime, he'd moved us over from Canada. This was in 1913, I can remember it plain.
He moved over,
He moved us over to Beale's Island. And we just there 11 months when the Canadian government drafted him and had to move everybody back and abandon all this boat work. The fellow that was partnered with him, George Addington, was of the draft age, and he got picked up and shoved in the army. He got put overseas. And he was over there all during the war. And when he got out of the army, he had no desire much to go back in boat building again. He'd accumulated a veteran's bonus and saved what little army pay. He was a very saving guy. And he came back and he worked for father for a while. But let's see, father had to go back to Canada. He moved us all back. And we got a farm settled on it. But papa didn't have no part of a farm. He went up to Digby, building tugboats for the Canadian government.
Oh, yeah. That makes sense.
And boy, of course, he just wasn't contented there. And he told Mama, he says, sister, if the war is over, he says, I'm going back, he says, over to Jonesport. Well, sir, he came on the farm, my grandfather, who was a fish processing buyer. There was a big British freighter run ashore down at called Northwest Ledge off of Yarmouth, Nova Scotia, in the winter of 1917. She loaded with a general cargo, 10,000-ton ship named the Corinthian. She hit the 17th day of December. My youngest brother was born that day. She broke in two hours, and on deck she was loaded with this Sitka spruce in 60-foot lengths. It was 12 by 12, and they're shipping it to England for the Sopwith planes and things in the First War. Well, the Bay of Fundy's full of it.
Yeah.
But Dad went down with his brother-in-law, and they went out, and they got thousands of feet of it, and they hauled it to my grandfather's place, and they hauled it up in the bank.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't know how many barrels of flour and pork that Papa got that was floating out of Vietnam.
Yeah.
Of course, she was loaded with everything. Flour was beautiful flour.
Wow.
It was in cotton bags inside of burlap bags.
Hmm.
And it would soak about that thick with dough and float right on the water just like a...
Oh, yeah.
That's as far as it would soak. That dough would stop, you see.
Yeah.
Papa picked up 24 barrels of it, and it was a barrel to a bag.
Yeah.
They'd empty that in the flour belt. Of course, we always, big family, are 10, 12 barrels of flour a year because your mother never had cooking then bread. She'd cook it. Well, anyway, Grandfather came to see Papa up on the farm, Lake Midway. "Will, as I want you to build me," he says, "as long a sardine carrier as you can make with that Sitka spruce." So Father went to a 58-footer, and her name was the Frieda and Blatch, and he built her on a farm, 5 miles from the water. Took 20 yoke oxen to haul her up to the water and down on the beach down to Centerville.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he just about got that done when the war was over.
Mm-hmm.
And boy, he just hightailed over them.
Yeah.
Over to Jonesport, or Beale's Arms, part of Jonesport. Now, when he got over there in his old original shop that he had, the elements had caught up with it and that fallen down.
Mm-hmm.
And when he got another smokehouse up the other end of the island, up pretty near where Harold Gower's shop is now, and he started another shop there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when he brought the... And this, by this time, the four-cycle engine had taken over.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he had his chance to shine, so then that was when he brought the thoroughbred out. The first one he built was the Red Wing. She was a sister ship to the thoroughbred, but the thoroughbred, he improved a little bit. Papa always trying to improve.
Yeah.
So then he came up with the thoroughbred. And I wouldn't know, I would say roughly, he probably built 50 boats of that type, one right after the other.
It must have been pretty popular.
And then, oh yeah, the more he could do, he always employed about 7 to 9 men year round, see. He always was loaded with work until the stock market crash came and then Europe's depression, I mean.
Yeah.
And then no one had any money here or nothing.
It was hard generally.
So, that's taking you up to about
1929.
Now, let's see.
That's when the crash was.
Yeah, let's see. The thoroughbred, let me see, when he left off with that type of boat was about 1923 or 4, he left off with that type of boat. Then, in the meantime, some of these round sterns got weak, which could happen, you know, stuff to do, you pass and let go. And everybody wanted a boat that was easier to maintain, and Father, I believe, built the first cut-off stern boat, as we know it now, along the main coast. This was 1924. That's the stern like we have now.
Tilted a bit aft.
Huh?
Tilted
a bit aft, yeah. They were pretty boats. And then he came out with a trunk cabin on them. And instead of having a little cutty slide, they had a little bit of a pilot house. Couple little octagon front, couple little windows in here that they could get in. Fishermen thought that wonderful.
Yeah, get out of the
had a little wheel down on the side right in here, the away, trotted here. And I wouldn't know how many he built like that, probably 24 or 5 of them.
They still had that good flat run.
They
were good and deep forward.
Yeah.
Nice?
Yeah. That's
when do you leave off that laminated stem?
Why, I believe he left that off. I know he left that off when he left off this style, about 1923.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Then he went into the molded stem, and that was also the same time he went into the two-piece shaft log, like I'm using.
Yes, two-piece new.
Yeah, because previous to that, they used to bore the shaft logs.
Yeah.
You used to lose one out of three. Your auger would hit a knurl and go up through the side, and you used to, I've seen him select the oak. Used to use a lot of good birch. Yellow, used to get a lot of yellow birch in those times. Mm-hmm. I've seen him look that stick over for which way the grain was going. Always go up the sawmill and watch the guy and make sure that hot grain was kept in the middle of your wood and everything,
yes.
You know.
Yes.
So, but that became so fluky and risky that he says, well, I got a way of making my shaft longs. Because when he done it, he scored him with a handsaw,
mm-hmm.
and dug him up with a gouge. Of course, I do mine now. I do them all with a router. I got cutters in my router. I make that shaft hole in there in just about 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Just curiosity, the name Red Wing makes the name Red Wing on that thoroughbred type model.
Well, I got that name.
Yeah,
he sold the Red Wing engine.
That's what I was wondering.
Yeah. Red Wing Thoroughbred, it was called.
Oh, uh-huh.
Made
uh-huh.
Red Wing, Minnesota.
Yeah.
Were they the predominating engines around here at that time? Hello, Joe.
Hello.
The predominating engines around here at that time was the Kermuth and the Red Wing. And then in later years, they commenced to get the KD4, and they got the New Jersey. These were Model T Ford adaptations.
Yeah.
Now, I could name you 100 marine engines in those times. We had several Niagaras, the Sterns, and the Sterlings,
mm-hmm.
and Frisbees. Oh, God. Stuff you never heard tell of. These, same as the automobiles have faded. There was, these were all marine engines, most of them were. The New Jerseys was a Model T Ford block, but that cast iron base and reverse gear and stuff.
That's where I met you.
Huh?
You're driving too.
What?
Of course, he's the wrong way, too.
Oh.
That's Luke Garrett.
Oh, yeah.
One year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Remember the crank I had on
them? Yeah, I had a crank. I had a ratchet.
Yes, sir. That was quite
sprocket chain, that crank of mine.
Mitchell, that ruined a few thumbs.
I don't think they could kick back on you, could they, Joe?
Huh?
No, they had a ratchet.
Yeah, I know, but they didn't kick back.
You do?
If the ratchet foul up a grease or something,
I was thinking they had a ratchet that disengaged when they kicked back. But that was a... and then it came along... the rum running days. Then they commenced. They commenced to make these boats with the trunk cabins and the hauling houses. Hauling houses on them. See.
Looks like a modern day shelter.
Yeah.
Just like that.
That's right. And there wouldn't be more than today. There wouldn't be more than four or five boats in this whole fleet out of Jonesport and Beals that's got south bend and cockpits.
Mm-hmm. Even now.
Even now.
Yeah. They want to keep that freeboard
down. They want to keep that freeboard down, and they like just the board floor.
Yeah.
In the summertime, they'll take the boards up when they paint them, dry them out.
Yeah.
Especially if this 4th of July race, they'll...
strip them loose.
They'll dry all that stuff, won't they, Joe? Yeah. Well, then the rum running days come along. There was a fellow named Winklepaw. Came from Rockland originally. He was an aviator, though. And he got in the rum running. He got up in New Jersey. And he came down here in the fall of 1925. He bought every lobster boat he could find in sight. He bought, he took away 16 at one time.
Boy.
He take them over to Eston Beals and Beals on a 50 horse Kermit in them. And away you go up New Jersey with them for a run and rum.
Yeah.
Everybody sold the boat.
Yeah.
Then, in the fall of 1928, Father had so much work to do. When this lumber would come from up and back to sawmills, oak keels and things, this stuff was green, it would sink. We'd dump it off a wharf, tow it over to Beals Island. Well, you'd have to tie 1,000 feet of cedar onto an oak keel. And Papa always got stuff enough to last him a year.
Yeah.
Then you'd tow it across it over to Beals Island, and you'd back it up the beach, get it hauled out. There'd be six men would be a week getting that stuff up on the bank and stop. So father says, well, gee, the best thing for me to do is get onto the mainland. So he moved over here and moved to shop over 1928 over here at Marine College. Got the place now.
Uh-huh.
Started the shop then, because Skids was under him the bank holiday, because we was building yachts for the Bar Harbor trade, North Haven, all that crowd, see.
Yeah.
Who? God, I don't know. He built so many. Huh?
The last one we built down there, sailing yacht.
Was it a particular design? Was it a racing design?
I know they had all kinds of problems.
His daughter
was a goddamn drunk. She wouldn't even bring a bottle of
champagne open.
You went wet, I guess.
That takes in the history of the lobster boat.
Yeah, pretty well. In other words, when he got under this model with the shelter after the
time you get up into that, you was up about in the 20s, in the late 20s.
Now, they were, how wide were they?
Father stayed narrow. God's trouble with father. He would build a 38-foot boat and he'd only go 8 foot wide with it. He thought that was awful wide.
That thoroughbred's awful narrow, I noticed.
Oh, she's 6 feet wide.
Uh-huh. Like a needle, isn't it?
Yeah, 6 feet wide. He was looking at her.
She's laid up over there, over on the way around to Alley J.
Yeah.
I guess somebody ran into her. She's hauled up there, ran into her with a car, and the stove front end.
Walking that kid got drunk and hit her a year ago last winter.
So her standing
moved her the length of it.
Yeah.
He had a Thunderbird car. The car wasn't much count when he got done.
Yes, I say. And all it did is just sort of demolish the stem of the flag.
Yeah.
It was fine.
Yeah.
Well, probably.
But, that was a...
That's the development of it.
That's the development of it.
How much longer did he build?
Father, he built until he was... He built boats until he was 85 years old.
So he kept right on pretty much...
Then he got up the Western. Well, previous to that, in the winter of 1934, we moved away from here, he and I both.
Yeah.
And we went up, worked for Balsa,
uh-huh.
Medford. We worked there 3 years, then we went down into Tiverton, Rhode Island. We rigged a shop up, machinery in it and everything. It was a big building, about four times as big as this, and it was made for mending seines and these floating fish traps.
Yeah.
Upstairs, there was a big bull wheel, and they used to hoist these nets up there, and down below, they take a net 1,000 feet long and spread it, fleet it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and they put it in these cribs. Well, they found out it's more convenient for them to go out in the field and work in the spring of the year than it was trying to do it in the building. So we hired the building, we got it all rigged out, put benches in it and lights and everything, and the 1938 hurricane come along and took the building, our machinery, our tools and everything.
Blew it.
They went.
Hmm.
Well, we hung on there, and they got a government loan, the people who owned the property, we leased it from them, and they built a big new shop. We built it, father and I, but the financial damage was done to us. We only lasted about 3 years because we had the money when we rigged up. After all, you put your money in your machinery, you know, and then you lose it, no insurance on it.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
you're done.
Yeah.
So Dad only lasted a couple, 3 years, and then he gave up, and he came back. And I had a sister who owned some overnight cabins up here in Farmingdale, Maine. And her husband was a veteran from the First World War, and he was half the time he's in Togus, and another time he's at Walter Reed Hospital. And, so my father helped her take care of the camps, and she leased them to the government workers. And right down out in Richmond, Maine, they started a shipyard there, building these big wooden barges. And they had two or three foremen there, and they didn't know their ass from a hole in the ground. And they got these barges, and they built one of them over a honeypot. It was quicksand, and she commenced to break in two. And Captain Proctor, he's over here in Machiasport now, is in charge of it, but he didn't have any skilled help. They were taking house cotton or anything, and they got down there, and they hadn't cut no rabbit line in the stem, no rabbit line in the keel or anything before they started assembling, and there was a bunch of men in there, and oh, what a mess. The barges was 250 feet long, big wooden barges. So they put Papa in charge of it, and he was there about a year and a half. Well, then the war was over, and he got through. In the meantime, when he got through, he started building some little outboard boats and selling them beside the road. Well, then my brother-in-law got well and recovered and come back home. He and Father didn't hitch very well. He was an awful wicked man, so Father didn't like his tongue. He got out and he come up to Portland. And my sister Irma lives over in Milbridge now. And Papa bought a farmhouse together. It had a woodshed, a barn, everything, right out in Deering, Allen's Corner, in Deering section of Portland. And by gosh, Father knew more about that place, and they heard that Will Frost had a boat shop. And they commenced to show up. Lyman Alley, you know it. He showed up from up Kittery, and he said, Bill, he says, can you build me a lobster boat? Something that'll go like hell. Father says, boy, you want a boat? He says, yes. And he says, here's $1,000. He says, go ahead. And Father built right there 24 boats. He had a nice deal because he had took this barn. He didn't have to do much, so he whitewashed it. Nice headroom. Heated it. His electric current come out of a meter on his house. His electric bill was only $15 a month. And he got Delta saw. Nice for two or three man shop. And he done that for 3 or 4 years and he made money. Well, then he thought, he was young, and he went over to South Portland. He hired a big building over there and started in. And then Mama went mental, and then Papa got a growth on his breast, and he had trouble. Mm-hmm. He sent Rhode Island for me to come take his business over, which I did. But Papa done his bookkeeping on a piece of board. Mm-hmm. And when I got all of his debts together, I couldn't swing it. He told me he owed about $2,000. I didn't mind paying off $2,000 a year, but when you get up around $4,500, and the creditors won't leave you alone. So I paid it off for $1,700, and then I threw my hands up. Mm-hmm. Then I went to Cape Cod to work. But he, off and on, by golly, he straight up, he was 85 years old, he built boats.
Boy, takes a man of iron to keep going.
Yeah.
Oh, want to take a breather?
Huh?
Want to take a breather?
Your skiff overall? 12 feet?
Okay.
10 feet?
You got 10 on the bottom, but I tell you it won't be about 12 feet long. You get
11 feet will do it around the outside. If she's 10 feet through the middle, 11 feet will do it around the outside.
11 feet more?
Yeah.
You know, but you've got to go around the bend.
Yeah, that's right.
Huh?
Yeah, that's right. 11 feet will do it. You'd have just 7 inches difference, tell you the exact truth. 11 feet will leave you a little bit over.
Huh?
11 feet will leave you a couple, 3 inches out over the allowing for extra. I know that I built about 400 skiffs in my life.
Well, that's what I want.
All right.
You know what I want them? How wide are they?
The outside ones, you want them 1¼ by 5/8. I can tell you before you tell me.
Okay. Then you know
Jim
Romo.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a man who's got it all in his head.
Built too many of them, Joe.
And now the middle strip, what does that
want? I make that 3 inches wide by 5/8.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How much are you going
to cost? Huh?
How much are you going to cost? How big does that want, baby? 5/8?
5/8, 6. 5/8, 3/4. Anywhere in that neighborhood.
Okay. I'll come down tomorrow and get them.
Good enough.
Tomorrow, I'll come down. Come down.
Building a punt or skiff?
Huh?
Building a skiff?
Who, me?
No,
we put some chafing gear on.
Just repairing,
yeah.
Yeah.
Comes time once in a while. Quite a bit, isn't it?
That, Joe, is a stern for my boat.
Yeah, I think it is.
That's going to be my boat right here I'm building.
You're building this one for yourself?
Yeah.
No.
33-footer.
Yeah.
Pretty nice looking to me. Good workmanship.
You're going to build one for yourself?
Yeah. I never owned a boat, and I'm 61 years old, and here's the time I'm going to own one. I'm not going lobster, and I'm just going to build it to have. I'm not going to add to your sorrows or any other fisherman's sorrows. I'm just going to... I just tired and sick of being land-based, and I'm going to get up and enjoy myself a little next summer.
How long will it be before you have her finished?
I'll have her by the 1st of July. Yeah. I want to get in that 4th of July race.
Oh, I see what you're up to.
I might get in the 4th of July race.
Take her out of the shakedown and win the race. Yeah. Win the race on the shakedown.
I couldn't race it, because, I mean, that's supposed to be, you know, a fisherman owner operated on.
Yeah.
I might just go as a pace boat or something on it.
Yeah. Any good thing?
I got a Cadillac going in.
How big?
350 horse.
That ought to do it. That's quite a pace, Pete. What do you have to do? Do you have to modify the engine or transmission on the engine?
No, I buy a conversion kit.
Uh-huh.
Bog one or reduction reverse gear.
How fast are you going to go
there? Huh?
How fast are you going to go there?
How what?
How fast is she going to go?
I don't know until I try her out. I'll make her go.
What do you think?
I worked on the design, Joe. I worked about 3 weeks.
How wide you gonna build?
Should be 33 long, 10 foot wide.
10 foot wide.
That's about standard width, is it? No.
Well, yeah, it could be. That's what it figures out for me.
Yeah. They're getting wider all the time, aren't they?
Well, there's the stern. Now you can put 5 traps across it. So they tell me.
Uh huh. Good. Now they're getting, I think, down to Mount Desert, some of them are getting too wide. Some fellas try 14.
You got one of them built down the road block?
I don't know. I can't tell you, Joe. We try.
I think you're probably good for you or people pretty
old. Huh? Oh, yeah, but they ain't much that drive either, is there?
I don't know.
It's got no ceiling in there.
Okay.
Oh, hell no.
I wouldn't have
to
with
the
boat.
Huh?
I wouldn't have to with the boat.
She's just a shell.
You don't like?
Well, Joe.
I've had no boat, Bill. I've had no ceiling.
I can't see without it.
Huh?
I can't see him without it.
Why?
I'd want all the shit and corruption getting in behind the ribs. Joe, the biggest damn mistake they ever make around here on sealing on boats. Everyone do it, and the reason they do it's an easy way out of it. They go ahead and they get this goddamn wet pine.
Yeah.
Half inch thick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they sock it right onto the ribs. They don't paint the boats inside at all.
No. Mm.
These boats, every square inch of them, come in and look in this one, they're all red leaded. Anyone would only take 8 hours. I can do one in complete myself, and I'm no professional painter. In 8 hours, red lead that boat, or painter, or something other, instead of leaving that raw wood.
Yeah.
Remember, you've got a board floor,
yeah.
Cracks in it, and salt water don't rot. It's salt doesn't rot, salt preserves. But when the dew gets in them, and when the fresh water gets in them,
mm-hmm.
That gets in and it gets in the pockets, and the planking, and behind the ceiling, and it rots. This is your trouble, but if you go ahead, I take cedar, and I make my ceiling out, and I split it. You don't need heavy ceiling.
Yes, but you know, you do.
And you leave an airspace. Come up and look at the airspace. You leave an airspace so you can get some circulation of air in them.
Yeah. But you do know, you remember, when they go right down in the bilge, right down on the turn.
I never had any of my boats ever go there. In the first place, I don't believe in splitting a rib.
No.
That's no damn good.
You mean that split all
the
way
around? They split them all around on the island. They split them clear down within a foot of the keel.
Yeah.
What the hell strength you got?
Yeah.
You just got another pocket for water and rot to get in, and it's hidden. You can't see it.
Yeah.
You're fastened, you have a chance to be attacked in. And they won't modernize on that stuff on the island to save them. Every damn one of them splits the ribs that way. Just for the sake of steaming them. You steam them an extra hour, you can bend any rib.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you don't have that reverse curve. You're not flanking down either. You don't have that problem with
no.
That reverse. I think
God damn it, I'll plank one down now, and I won't split it either.
Uh-huh.
No, I'll steam my rib for the bins. The hell with it. I'll select the rib for the job. I can do that.
Uh-huh.
I take all of my ribs before they're ever put in a boat, and they're all painted with linseed oil, boiled linseed oil, before they're ever put in a steam box.
Uh-huh.
When you put the steam to them, you drive the oil in them. And boy, if you can't bend them, there's something wrong. And once they dry overnight, they're as hard again as they were, so you didn't treat them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there anything to put in salt in the boat?
That's only for purposes for, generally they do it for freezing in the...
Keep the ice out of them.
Keep the ice out of them, that's
ice
all.
Wintertime.
I don't know, the old sailing vessels years ago, before they ever put the covering boards on, they used to fill them right so full of rock salt between the ribs. But they still rotted.
Yeah.
They still get fresh water in, because the weak point around them was around the rail stanchions.
Yeah.
They'd work the wedges out. They used to, so finally some of them got wise, the old fellas, and they started dipping them in tar and driving them.
Mm-hmm.
Then they eliminated a lot of that. But it's quite a trick to fit a stanchion wedge.
Pleasant.
She's going to Cape Cod. Party boat. Yeah.
You for going out for deep sea fishing, this kind of thing?
Huh?
For deep sea fishing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, she's got wide enough walkways here, too.
Well,
so
you see, my boat's wide and they got a lot of fair flare. Why should you try to walk around on a deck that wide? What you going to do if you don't pull your houses in?
Yeah.
What you going to do with all this deck? You still got ass loads of room. You can know why you can touch your shoulders or anything in that boat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I always do.
That makes it stronger?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Stronger and beautiful.
You tell me, that damn stuff won't stick on now. See ya.
Well, it's all according to what you're going to call. Yeah, they got it'll stick on cedar. Don't you think they haven't? But, Joe, fiberglass is perfect on plywood, because plywood doesn't contract and expand. It can't. But when you put it on cedar planking, your cedar planking, if it gets damp, is going to come and go. You can't see it with the eye, but it does. You know, you put a boat over and it leaks, and overnight it tightens up, don't it? Something swells, doesn't it? So fiberglass becomes rigid, and when it swells, that wood's got so much power, she'll crack the fiberglass. Now, you may not see that crack with a naked eye, but it's there.
Yeah,
it's just like a fine crack in a glass. It's there. I've tried it. To tell you the truth, no. Nobody can fiberglass this boat here, plank out of cedar, and make it that good.
Mm-hmm. Water get under and start lifting off the fiberglass
right.
Eventually. Yeah.
Cedar's got a certain amount of oil in it.
Yeah. Well, have you made any innovations on your father's design? Have you built on his line very much?
No, I've got my own design. I never... I'm strictly on mine. Huh? I never built a narrow boat in my life. After father got True in Tiverton, Rhode Island. I hung by Dad all these years.
Mm-hmm.
Done an awful lot of his design work for him. I took a course in ICS, in ship design.
Mm-hmm.
And it meant a lot to me. And then I got around in Rhode Island in good yards where I worked with naval architects and marine engineers. And I learned all the fine points of it and all the engineering and all that goes in. I knew all the functions of everything, the strengths of all the stuff. It's what I wanted to know. And I was just, in fact, Father said to me about 3 years before he died. Old Bert, he says, I was awful foolish man. He says, I was set in my ways. He said, I couldn't see making a boat wide. He said, I couldn't see a 300 horsepower engine now not taking up much more space or weighing any more than the old one cylinder engine. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was too late in life, and he hated to change his ways, see? But for what he could build was graceful and beautiful.
Yep. And he also, being a, you know, a mature builder, he knew what he what
yeah,
was good.
And that's right.
He had good
but Papa put out an honest product. Papa put out an honest product, and his boats lasted good, didn't they, Joe?
Yeah. You've got to admit that Longmont beat the old thoroughbred.
Huh?
There's a long while being the old thoroughbred for you.
That's what I say. That's what I say. But she went up to a point where if you'd have hung a big engine like you did today, she's unstable. She, she's all God, she went out of control.
Yeah.
You wouldn't dare put her in a race with one of these modern boats.
Uh-huh.
Oh, hell, she'd hit one of them quadrants, she'd flip over.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have the area there.
Yeah. No. Didn't have the bearings.
Didn't have the bearings there. Oh, no, you got a different boat altogether today.
You know what I'm
talking
about, you.
Huh?
Now, you know that old member who was just been born in the town, he was in a heavenly good treatment or something. Father of God, boy, don't you think I even out there from bad weather with him?
Yeah.
You realize when you haul there ashore, there's only about that much that was flat on their staff. There's a hole in
there. Yeah. That's right.
Hit very bad, isn't it?
That's right. That's what I say. I'm pretty sure if you took that one of them fast boats like the Thoroughbred or the Red Wing and got her in that cluster of boats with all of that backwash from all those propellers and those quadrant seas, I'm afraid that you wouldn't have the guts to stick by her. I wouldn't know what she'd do. But I know this Bob Smith up here in West Jonesport probably must be as good a seafaring man as there is around, and he got in a race just once. And it scared the shit out of him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he had a modern boat, and he said, no more for me. He quit, boy, after that.
Takes quite a boat, doesn't it?
He said, boys, they got to have a lot more backbone and guts than I've got. He hit on the turn.
He's on the turn,
boys, and by God, he started side-slipping, and another guy zinged by him and got him. Christ, he went over because he banged another boat. How are you going to handle that quick?
Yeah.
Huh? And you take one of them narrow deep boats, and she's out, all she's gone, she's all teeter. They told me the Thoroughbred with that big Buick in her was all a teeter, like there's Roger Beale up here over there, and he told me. He said, it's the funniest feeling you ever had, ever experienced, he said, in that boat hooked up.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought of.
Yeah, you got an old Hayford boat, he's got an old
running
sharp boat.
Running out of sea, see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
She feels all alive,
Is she deep, really fine forward?
Yeah, real fine. Real fine.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You ever have any danger of broaching, possibly? Or?
No.
She's not that buoyant, huh?
Of course, you do run under that hatch.
Huh?
Huh?
Yes.
She what?
If there's rock, you know, from choppy, she's gay and dead.
Yeah.
If you go from, she'll jump right from one seat to the other.
Yeah. Must be a tough feeling.
This interview continues on side two, and there's a slight overlap.